Welcome to Medical Confessions,
your remedy for serious medicine. I'm Jen.
I'm April.
And I'm Scott. Today we're going to be talking about if you can actually get some protection by being drunk in a car wreck. Thought process is out there that if you're drunk, you can survive these car wrecks because you're all floppy, and that's a good thing.
I believe this to be 100% true. I have seen far too many car wrecks, and both sober and non-sober people, and I feel like the non-sober people tend to do very, very well in their wrecks where you see the vehicle and are like, there's no way somebody survived this, and they're standing out there like Barney from Simpsons. Hi, guys. You know, just like everything's fine. Whoops. You know, and I hate to actually bring humor to something that's kind of sad and serious because there's a whole other side to DUIs.
That's our podcast,
it is,
right?
It is. But I do feel like people do well drunk. And I think that it matches up with what people are like when they're not in automobiles. So like when someone's drunk, you see the people at the stadium that fall down the stairs and like clearly that is going to hurt and they pop up like it's nothing. And I bet you when they sober up, it's horrible. But I just feel like there is something to the theory that being drunk helps them flop around in the car and not get hurt.
Before I did this research, I would have agreed with you, and now I'm like, yeah, that doesn't make sense. That is not actually the case.
Okay.
Weird.
Wow. Well,
who knew?
April, what's our history?
The Russman Law Group has a blog page, and they have a pretty good history of DUI laws through 2004. It states the first jurisdiction to adopt laws against drunk driving in the United States was New York in 1910. The public...
Wow, that's surprising, actually.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking it was like the 80s. I remember being a kid and, you know...
No seatbelts, of... no...
Yeah. All your grand... Well, I guess all my relatives, you know, you liquored up and they just, bye, guys, and drive home, and it was no big deal.
Well, the punishment was $1,000 and a year in jail. However, these early DUI laws simply prohibited driving while intoxicated. There was no set definition of what levels of inebriation qualified as drunk driving. In 1936, Robert Brookstein invented the drunkometer.
That sounds high tech, yeah. Just for the record.
Yeah. Well, it was a device similar to a balloon, which okay. People breathed into and determined whether they were drunk or not.
Did they smell it? Did they like, here, smell this? You're drunk.
In 1938, the American Medical Associates and National Safety Council began to study the problem of motor vehicle accidents related to alcohol. The two groups suggested establishing a specific blood alcohol content standard of 0.15%.
Wow, that's pretty high.
Yeah.
In 1953, Robert Brookstein invented the breathalyzer. The breathalyzer uses chemical oxidation and photometry to determine alcohol concentration. The machine measured the alcohol vapors in the breath and it would show the levels of alcohol in the blood. Is that true?
Mm-hmm. So we did this on a Why Alcohol Makes You Drunk episode. We talked about it, but about 5% of alcohol is excreted in your breath.
Okay.
So they love it when Scott feels like this is, yes, you should know this. It's a, yeah.
What?
Every time. It's a nice thing because Scott's not mean naturally, but if you say something
sometimes.
And it's like, well, it's kind of like, duh.
We talked about it.
I tried to explain that to Jess the other day. How he's like, no, but he's really nice about how he's telling you you're wrong.
Yeah, he smart you. Yeah.
During the 1960s, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration worked to show legislators statistics and graphs photo depicting the dangers of drunk driving. Their efforts led to states lowering their permissible BAC limits to 0.10 or 0.12. In 1972, states began to pass per se DUI laws, which states did not need to prove that the alcohol affected the driver's ability to operate the motor vehicle. They only needed to prove that the driver was operating above the BAC legal limit. In 1980s, groups like Mothers Against Drunk Driving and Students Against Drunk Driving began to lobby Congress for tougher legislation for those convicted of DUIs. They ultimately proved effective in tougher standards. In 2000, President Clinton's Transportation Appropriations Bill required all states to lower the permissible BAC to 0.08 by October 2003 or risk losing federal highway construction funds. The government concluded that lowering the permissible limit from 0.10 to 0.18 reduced alcohol-related fatalities by 7%, translating to 500 lives saved per year. By July of 2004, all 50 states had passed the legislation lowering the BAC limit to 0.08, which stands today.
And not to, like, totally interrupt history, did you guys read the recent article on the variability in blood alcohol tests that the police give the breathalyzers and the wide ranges that they are? And the manufacturers of these things are like, yeah, sometimes they're just not accurate.
Oh.
Isn't that crazy? It's in the New York Times.
So if you get a DUI, you should request a blood draw every time?
Well, and this was part of the article was like, but if you do, you're guaranteed to get your license taken away.
That's
kind of the rule. So you kind of have to. And they were kind of pointing out that everybody knows these variabilities exist. Not that the point is you shouldn't be drinking and driving anyway.
Sure,
but
sure.
If you are, these tests aren't as accurate as people used to think. Hmm. That was a New York Times thing. I think that makes sense, right? Like, do you want to talk about why alcohol makes you not be able to drive?
Sure.
Everybody's got neurotransmitters in their body, right? Some are excitatory neurotransmitters and some are inhibitory neurotransmitters. So glutamate is a neurotransmitter that is an excitatory one. It allows you to, you know, do fast muscle twitch stuff. You can squeeze harder. You've got more control of your muscles. So alcohol will actually sit on a glutamate receptor and not allow ion flow to go through that receptor, so that it sends off its signal. So basically you don't have any glutamate to make your muscles tense up or anything and you get floppy. That actually happens at a BAC of 0.03. So 0.08.
Super low.
Yeah, so 0.08, you're pretty far along into not being able to control your muscles
very well.
Well,
that makes sense to me, because if you have like a glass of wine, at least for me, like midway through the glass of wine, I'm like, oh. Like you can feel your body relax.
Well, and this is why they call alcohol a depressant, right? Because it's depressing your neurotransmitters. So, and I know a lot of countries have 0.04 alcohol content levels, when that makes more sense to me if you're getting this happening at 0.03. But then you've got to start talking about just being tired, right? We've talked about before where 17 hours after you wake up, you have the same neurotransmitter release or loss of muscle control as a 0.05.
Right.
Either way, so that's what alcohol is doing with glutamate. And the more alcohol you get in you, the more pronounced those effects are. So then the idea here is that if you get in a car wreck, you're floppy, and then your limbs, you're not able to tense up, and so your limbs become sort of an airbag to help you, and you can just kind of contort into all the positions that the car will put you in without any injury. And so that's the theory, anyway. It's not true.
It's not true. Okay, no, there it is.
And so, we should first start off by saying that there is no argument with the fact that if you are drinking, you're going to get hurt a whole lot more.
Right.
So some numbers, 40% of trauma deaths have alcohol involved. So almost half. So you're going to take more risky behaviors. You're going to do stupid stuff, right? Everybody knows, here, hold my beer, watch this. That's not going to end well for somebody. So we'll just say right now, if you drink, you got a much, much chance higher of getting hurt. But now the question is, if you are drunk, are you going to get hurt in a car wreck as easily? So again, I think the joke was we don't live in Nazi Germany where we can just like put a bunch of people in a car and smash them into walls and say, you're drunk, did you live or not? You know, can't do it. But the anecdotal evidence out there says no. So there was one study published in 2010 in the Journal of American Medical Association looking at alcohol. The title of it was Motor Vehicle Crashes, the Association of Alcohol Consumption with the Type and Severity of Injuries and Outcomes. And what they found was there was zero association between injury severity and alcohol level. They couldn't find a link at all. Further studies that were done later found that people who are drunk have a better chance of more head, abdominal, and chest injuries. So the argument then could be made that if you're not stiff, you're going to just hit the front of the car a lot more readily, and head, chest, and abdominal injuries, much more chance of dying than if you've got some broken bones because you stiffed up or something. So the anecdotal evidence says there's nothing that will protect you from your injuries just because you're drunk. But no one's ever done a prospective study either, because you can't, right? There's ethics in medicine, and we can't get people liquored up and smash them into a wall.
Right.
So it's probably good.
Well, that was a short episode.
Then it gets crazy from there, though.
Right. And this is probably where you're going with it, because I read an article where there was Dr. Friedman, and I don't know, there was a statement in this article that was more profound to me, where he's basically saying that it's the physiological responses that alcohol helps you with. Would that be accurate?
100%.
So, okay, because that's the what I read. And I think I was thinking more along those lines of you almost don't even know that you just got into a wreck. So not so much that you can get tossed in the car and not sustain injury, but you fall down the stairs at the stadium. You don't actually know it till the next day.
And you go home with a head bleed and then you die in your sleep.
Right.
It's like pain meds. You're in pain. You just don't care.
Yes. Right.
Right.
True. Well, and so this is the thing, right? So the answer to the question, no, being drunk won't help you from getting injured. But if you are injured, so you do have to actually make it to the hospital for all of this stuff to take effect. And alcohol does have some things that will help you in certain types of traumatic injuries, but there are studies all over the place that some say yes and some say no. And so we'll talk about both of them. But the first one is going to be in 2012, Lee Friedman. He's from the University of Illinois, Chicago. He did a study.
I'm so excited that I found something that Scott was using. It's just not like BuzzFeed article that I typically come up with.
We're going to talk about him because he's been doing a lot of studies on this stuff. It's kind of cool. But what he found was that alcohol levels decrease mortality rate in every type of traumatic injury, right, whether it's crush injuries, stabbings, gunshot wounds, whatever it is, falls, except for burn patients. And that makes sense because alcohol is a known immunosuppressant. So your immune system's going to be suppressed. And everybody knows burn patients get infections and they die of infections. So that makes sense. And he said the higher the, in this study, the higher the blood alcohol content, the greater the benefit of the alcohol. And so he found mortality rates decreased by up to 50% in some cases. Crazy, right?
Yeah. Well, and actually, this is the statement I was talking about that he said. He said, you don't die from the injury itself. You die from the subsequent physiological response, things like inflammation and rapid fluid loss. If you get shot by a gun, it's not the hole that kills you.
Yes.
I just thought that was interesting. Yeah.
Sometimes it is.
Yeah. Sometimes it is. Well, it's the blood that comes out of the hole that, you know.
Well, and so in this study he did in 2012, he said, we don't know why. So 2014, he was like, well, let's look at it. And it was the complications you're talking about, right? Like, so he found that of people who die from traumatic injuries, about half of them had a complication. And it was the complication that killed them, not the injury. So he started breaking down the different complications and looking at what alcohol did for you. And he found a reduction in cardiac complications by 23.5% and a reduction in renal complications by 30%. So his thought was that we need to look at the different types of complications, see what alcohol's doing and how it can help. But he overall said it will help. But then another study came out in the European Journal of Trauma and Emergency Surgery.
Always one-upping each other.
I know, right? And they actually found the exact opposite. They found that mortality increased twofold, so 100% if you had alcohol on board. And that penetrating trauma were more likely to be admitted with no vital signs, so if you got stabbed or shot. And most trauma patients were more hypotensive and less awake. So they had a lower GCS score. It's a Glasgow Coma score, and that's what we use to determine your mentation level. And so they found that all of these things were happening the more alcohol you had on board, which is the exact opposite of what Friedman found. And what they said was alcohol alters hemodynamic, metabolic, and inflammatory homeostasis after hemorrhage, blunts catecholamine surge, and that'll come into play here in a minute, decreases threshold for ventricular arrhythmia. So basically they're saying you're going to bleed more because you can't clot off and your sympathetic nervous system can't work, your fight or flight, and your heart is more susceptible to these rhythms that will cause you to die. But then they also said this is actually opposite of what everybody else is saying, and this is just going to lead to controversy. So who knows? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't.
Well, and is there ever going to be anything definitive on this? So I'm going to bring in a personal related story. A certain person I know has a smarty pants perfect girlfriend.
Okay.
They did a run.
There's a good chance.
There's a good chance they drank too much the night before.
100%
chance. She performs amazingly well and just kills him. He cramps up and cries like a baby the rest of the race. So can it vary so much in between human to human and depending on, you know, that there's not even really any way to determine whether it's a help or a hindrance. And basically I'm just saying if you and your girlfriend got in a wreck, she would have survived and you would have died. But
well, it could be that she actually trained and someone didn't. That was probably part of it as well.
All I'm hearing excuses.
All I'm hearing is you suck. So alcohol tolerance is a thing, right? Just like tolerance to coffee is a thing. It's
Are
a
you
diuretic.
Calling your girlfriend an alcoholic?
Wow.
God, I hope not.
Because I'm feeling like that's where we're going to segue into.
I think we should move on. No, I mean, so you can have like an alcohol tolerance outwardly, but you're still going to, the alcohol is still going to affect glutamate receptors the same. And it's still going to affect these things the same. And in this particular case, it's the dehydration, right? Someone was really dehydrated to start and they shouldn't have been. Yeah. But that's what happens.
That was my question kind of with the per se laws. I was like, oh, they got smart because people are like, alcohol wasn't affecting my driving ability because we have have that person at work. Do you know how many beers
he was... It was a lot.
It was like 11 shots. It was the training for the new cops to see if they could do the breathalyzers and all
right.
of the field sobriety
tests. And so
tests.
This person we know, did 11 shots, and they still could not, the field sobriety test, prove that he was intoxicated.
That's what it was.
Well, and so it's weight-based, too, right? Like anything. So the more you weigh, the more you're going to be able to drink, you know, just
right.
volume-wise. When it comes to overall trauma, will it help? Will it not? Probably in some cases. The study that said it didn't, they were looking at all types, but specifically traumatic brain injury, it's known that it will help. There's been several animal studies and a really good human study that alcohol helps. Alcohol increases your chance of a traumatic brain injury by astronomical percents in car wrecks.
Yeah.
But it will actually help with traumatic brain injury. So we talked about this study they said wouldn't help. They said that alcohol blunts catecholamine surge, which is your fight or flight nervous system, so things like epi and norepi. So in traumatic brain injury, it's known that traumatic brain injury people have increase in epi and norepi. They have an increase in glutamate and aspirate, which are all of these excitatory neurotransmitters. The problem with that is when you get all of those neurotransmitters going, you'll get a calcium influx into your brain cells, and that calcium influx kills mitochondria. Mitochondria make ATP, and ATP is the molecule that makes everything in the cell work. So if you kill the mitochondria, you're going to kill the cell's ability to work, so it dies. Sodium influx will also happen, and that will swell up the brain cell because osmotic pressures are going to want to pull more fluid into the cell, and that'll kill the brain cell too. So if you can stop calcium and sodium influx by stopping catecholamines and stopping glutamate, you save brain cells. Well, that's what alcohol does. It sits on the glutamate receptor, doesn't let it work, and alcohol is known to not allow catecholamines to be released. So it will help with traumatic brain injury, but it's going to be an isolated injury, right?
Right.
Like, because you can't say they got a gunshot or they popped a lung and the
right.
head, because then it's, you know, that study's not been done, but it will help for TBIs. So I think that alcohol does have a role in some traumatic injuries. And if you're Lee Friedman, he's done lots of research that said it helps in a lot of types of injuries. But, you know, Europeans, not so much.
So it's just a fluke that we've seen these many wrecks and the drunks just walking away from them like it's...
Well, or is it confirmation bias? Because how many wrecks have we seen where it's like that guy is really messed up and he's hammered?
Well, and that's true, because I read a statistic that said that all motor vehicle accidents, 1/3 are alcohol-induced.
Mm. Yeah, well, and so one of the numbers was 36% of deaths from car wrecks from people aged 16 to 20 were from too much alcohol.
And so again, although we laugh and we make jokes, we don't really want to know that alcohol makes wrecks better, because we prefer that people weren't drinking to begin with.
Well, the chances of you getting hurt from having alcohol on board goes up astronomically when you're drinking. So the best treatment is just not to drink. But if you are in a wreck and you're already drunk, it's probably not going to do anything. It's not going to help you unless
hope
you have a TBI.
Hope for a brain injury.
But the chances are you're probably going to die, because how many car wrecks have we been on where they're just done?
Right. Yeah. I did read two funny DUIs that were actually pretty recent. So to lighten the mood a little bit, I want to bring these up. So within the last 2 years, there was, in Western Pennsylvania, there was a Thomas Moreau who got a DUI for driving his mower, it sounds like, kind of down the sidewalk in his neighborhood, and he had a beer in the cup holder, and he actually got a DUI for that.
Is a mower?
It's
a motorized. I thought it had to be licensed. Like, there's got to be some case law that says that's not accurate. But
oh, no, it's accurate.
Really?
Oh, yeah. In Grays Harbor, there's been those DUIs.
You sound like you're from...
Not from experience. It's a motorized vehicle, and I meant you can get a DUI on a bicycle.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't think I knew that. A bicycle?
Because I feel like people who lose their license from DUIs, that's what they do. They drive their bikes to the bar, don't they? I mean,
yeah, but you can still get a DUI on a bike. There's some states that have written laws specific about bikes and some that don't, but it's the thing.
What about a horse?
All right, here's the next one.
Oh.
Here's my next one. Thank you, guys, for the segue.
That's a good segue, yeah.
In New York, I'm assuming upstate, a 17-year-old Amish boy... got pulled over for a DUI. He had a horse-drawn carriage. He got belligerent when the law enforcement tried to pull him over, and he was under the influence of alcohol. So he got cited for several things. Number one, being under 21, obviously the DUI. Also, apparently he littered. And he also got cited for not adequate lighting on his carriage.
Oh, jeez.
They threw the book at him.
Yeah.
Dang.
So I just thought that those were kind of funny.
The horse one, like... So here's
maybe just a young Amish kid rebelling.
Well, like, if you're riding a horse, is the horse in control? Are you in control? Like,
well, it was a buggy, so it wasn't on the horse.
He's actually in control buggy. Then. But if you're riding the horse,
I don't know.
Does that count?
I don't know. I'm sure it does. I'm sure there's a case where that took place. Now I gotta Google it. It is possible to get a DUI while riding a horse. The charge carries, with a few exceptions, just as much weight as a DWI committed in a motor vehicle, with all of the legal consequences associated with such conviction.
In 1897, a 25-year-old London taxi driver named George Smith became the first ever person to be arrested for drunk driving after slamming his cab into a building. Smith later pled guilty and was fined 25 shillings. That was also the same year the first factory-made car was produced in Central Europe.
Can you imagine being that first guy? What? I can't drink and drive? Are you kidding me? When did this become a thing?
It's not as fun sober. Well, the one thing that I gathered from the article that you've written, that you forced April and I to read, was that there's actually three collisions that take place.
There is three collisions.
I liked that. I hadn't even thought about it before.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. Explain your three collisions.
Well, so the collisions are the car hitting the something, we'll call it a tree, you hitting the inside of the car, and then your organs hitting the inside of you. So this is why the fold like a pretzel floppy thing doesn't really make sense, because you're going to be hitting the front of that car harder, and so your organs are going to be more chance of getting damaged, and head injuries, chest injuries, stomach injuries, that's going to kill you. So it's probably going to be more chance in that, you know, anecdotally, because again, nobody's studied it.
I just thought that was a really juicy nugget that Scott had bypassed. Well, I thought it was good in demonstrating, you know, even when you're drunk, those collisions still take place.
It's going to happen. Your arms aren't as much of an airbag as you think. Well, we should shout out to Today I Found Out. If you want to read the article, go there and check out their YouTube channel soon, because it'll be on there very shortly.
Well, if you like what you saw or heard today, check us out on YouTube, a podcast,
or visit our website, medicalconfessions.com.